Events at the Salamander Hotel by Don Howarth.
In the summer of 1939, one of the most remarkable trials in British legal history was held at the Assize Court at Brigport in Lincolnshire. This dramatized reconstruction of the events that led to the trial is based on the court records and local memory, on the recollections of Mr. and Mrs. Sam Swindles of Melbourne, New South Wales, who knew the accused, of Inspector Fred Forage, now retired, who arrested them, and, on a previously unpublished source, letters written to his wife by the judge, the late Mr. Justice Arthur Poskett, K.C., to which access has been given by his son, Dr. Raymond Poskett of Southampton. The judge first visited Brigport in the summer of 1935, and like almost everyone else in those days, came on the train. Two carriages and a cattle truck, pulled by a bustling little engine slowly across miles of flat fields.
"Splendid landscape,"
the judge wrote to his wife.
"Men driving teams of horses. Endless horizons beneath great billowing banks of cumulus cloud."
The train brought nearly all the commercial travellers who used Brigport as a base when they were working the area. And on the day of the judge's arrival, he was followed by Frank Greenhouse, carrying leather suitcases fore and aft to avoid knocking the flowers growing along the platform garden. Frank called on farmers' chemists.
"Did you hear the one about the two flies?"
"Go on."
"There were two flies playing football in a saucer."
"And?"
"And one said to the other, 'We'll have to do better than this next week. We're playing in the cup.'" "There. Aspirins, cough medicine, horse pills, same again all the way through."
"Yeah, but no baby's balsam, Frank."
"Really?"
"Makes the poor little sods ill."
"Oh, pretty. Grocer fly papers?"
"Half."
"We have this, new gargle."
"No, thanks, Frank."
"Well, try this bottle yourself, Harry. And if you'd like a better gargle later, I'm over at the Salamander Hotel."
The Salamander was among the oldest pubs in Lincolnshire, kept by two bachelor brothers, Otto and Abraham Briggs, then around 60, who had learned their trade stabling horses and quartering travellers from their grandfather.
"And he, sir, was here established before the railway came. Long established. The Briggs of Brigport. Established innkeepers since the dawn of time."
The Salamander Hotel had enjoyed for centuries the distinction of affording lodging for the assize judge, and during his periods of residence, Otto Briggs brought in a cartload of competent countrywomen to cook and clean. Otherwise he had no interest in the accommodation side. The food was plain, the beds hard, and the bills inaccurate. But it was the only place to stay for those repelled by the shabby cheapness of its only rival, the Red Dragon, across the market square. Frank Greenhouse was a man of spirit. He chose to stay where judges stayed, to eat where Rotarians ate. George Blunston also stayed there, a different category of salesman, a self-employed businessman, sticking his own stamps on his card, a merchant, a capitalist, an entrepreneur.
"I'm not here today and gone tomorrow. I'm here today and gone today."
"Is that one of our suits, eh?"
"I thought so. I recognised it by its loudness and vulgarity. They're baggy, they're shoddy. They're nasty, but they're cheap. And if you don't mind how you look, it'll last you a lifetime. You wouldn't be seen dead in one." "Then buy one of our shrouds and you'll not live to regret the day."
George Blunston drove to the markets and to the doors of farmhouses in his own Austin 7, its body crammed with suits, underwear and shrouds. He himself wore a thornproof suit with a reinforced backside and leather leggings for protection against dogs.
"Get out, you stinking mongrel. Get out. Good afternoon, madam. What a nice dog. How are you fixed for combinations?"
The weeks that Frank Greenhouse and George Blunston used the Salamander Hotel as a base seemed to have more or less coincided over a number of years, and on one night of the week, there's reason to think it was Thursday, there was a sort of spontaneous coming together in the bar. The salesmen who were putting up in the hotel, those who came across from the Red Dragon, and Captain Creek, who kept a launch in the harbour. Nobody drank much. In those days, people scrupled to pay their rounds and knew the art of making drinks last.
There were two flies playing football in a saucer, and one said to the other,
"We'll have to do better than this next week. We're playing in the cup."
Captain George, may I present Alvin Chiana Globetrotter.
Before this, just the States and Canada.
San Diego?
No, not that far.
Ontario, that's been more your patch, eh, Alvin?
Well, Saskatchewan, Alberta, American Midwest.
Farm machinery.
All inland?
Well, some ports. Vancouver, B.C.
Yes, Vancouver.
Halifax.
Halifax? Nova Scotia?
Yeah.
Did you, by God, did you? No. Did you make the acquaintance of a Mrs. Winstanley?
I think maybe I...
Caroline Winstanley. In the days of coal, of course, charming woman. Now, George has heard this story, but I'd like you to listen because it illustrates something.
No, I haven't heard this one.
At these coaling stations, there used to be a race between the crews of different ships who could be the first to fill the bunkers.
Yeah.
5 to 7 hours solid shoveling men down the hole, sweating away and streaked with coal dust. Well, now, my captain, Bertie Banks, went to see how they were going on. "Are you working hard?" he shouted down. And they all shouted back, "Aye, aye, sir." "Well, damn you, work harder," he said.
"Damn you, work harder."
And that, whether you like it or not, my boy, is leadership.
Yes, sir.
Though, as a junior officer, I was not personally present at the time, being ashore making the acquaintance of Caroline Winstanley.
Oh, you should never trust a woman. You'll be sorry if you do. You should never trust a woman, or they just make a monkey out of you.
If you could possibly lay your hands on a pair of trousers, George.
Oh, next trip, Captain.
The reason being that these are part of my best uniform, and there, you see,
I'm through the breeches arse.
Oh. 12 bob. And that would
half
be...
half a crown down and 13 weeks to pay.
Bless you, George. The thing being that when ladies come on board, do I rise or must I remain seated? You see my quandary?
It really puts you behind the eight ball. Huh?
Yes, you can say that again.
Still very traditional here,
the judge wrote to his wife.
Church service before opening of assize, to which processed through Market Square choristers, self, Lord Lieutenant, halberdiers, sundry clerks.
We kindle God's wrath against us. We provoke him to plague us with diverse diseases and sundry kinds of death. Judge therefore yourselves, brethren, that ye be not judged of the Lord. Repent you truly of your sins.
Church absolutely filled,
the judge wrote to his wife.
Believe they get free beer afterward. Old Willie Wotherspoon, now bishop here, made best of it to saw away with the tedious sermon.
Let me say that justice must be seen to be done. We are referring not to a perception dependent upon acquaintance with law, which we, as laymen, cannot be expected to possess, but rather to an extra-legal perception of justice, transcending the laws made by man and owing its origin ultimately not to parliaments, but to what, for lack of a better word, we call God.
The procession leaving church crossed the sunlit market square to the judge's lodging in the Salamander Hotel, watched by many from overlooking windows. Among them were Frank Greenhalgh, the chemist salesman, and George Blunston, the outfitter, sitting at the window of the room that Greenhalgh had taken at the Red Dragon.
You won't get in over there tonight, George.
Mm?
They're not letting rooms because of this. Carry on.
It's a mistake to neglect the regulars. Well, I get a bed. They're full up in this place.
Just down here, George. There's two beds.
You sure you don't mind?
What do you have?
If it's all the same to you, certainly.
In this one. I like my head to point north.
Quite right, George.
Otto should never neglect his regulars.
Landlord positively lavished attention on me,
the judge wrote.
Said place had been judge's lodging for 5 centuries. Can well believe it. Great heavy beams, wall, floor and ceilings at all angles. Roaring fire.
Your hot toddy, Your Honour.
Hot toddy?
His Honour and Lordship Robinson, God rest his soul, was strong on the toddy. Your Honour and Lordship.
Well, thank you.
Forgive the scuffling outside, Your Honour. My saturnine and superstitious brother attends to be presented.
Please.
Sit. My brother Abraham, Your Honour. We was named after my grandfather's bloodhounds, Otto and Abraham. And they, in turn, were named after 2 historical figures, the Iron Chancellor of Prussia and the famed President of the United States, of whom, sir, you may have heard tell.
We has continued that tradition.
Historical references in the naming of dogs. You there!
The present pair being named after the war generals.
Hindenburg and Kitchener. Turn!
Of whom, likewise, you may have heard tell.
And went on, their hounds growling in accompaniment. Be friendly, but scoundrels to the core, I suppose. Willie Wotherspoon sent his motor car to fetch me. Dinner at his bishop's palace, then snooker on his new table. Gave him a thrashing and took 5 pence off him. He to bed angry, slamming doors. Nightcap with Virginia, then back to the salamander. Hard flock mattress.
The judge slept hard, but not nearly so hard as Alvin Chayanov, who was out until late trying to sell a mowing machine, and, unable to get a room at either hotel, stretched out on the floor of the bedroom at the Red Dragon, booked by Frank Greenhouse, in which the spare bed on the north-south axis had already been allocated, without the knowledge of the management, to George Blunston. There's no reason to believe at this stage there was any intention to defraud the hotel, but the fact is that all 3 men stayed the night, and only 1 paid. Frank Greenhouse sat late over his breakfast, reading the Daily Express and sorting out his order forms, and he caught the local bus just about the time the Court of Assize was opening.
Poor list,
the judge later wrote to his wife.
The usual catalogue of rural felonies, betrayed to the law by avaricious relatives or wronged women. Gave them a bit of a wigging.
Body snatching is an offence against the law, gentlemen of the jury. Prevalent though it may be in these parts, and likely regarded though it may be by those who sojourn here. It is most improper to dig up the bodies of the dead, unless such exhumation be required by law. And if it is true, as we have been told, that vergers and clerks in holy orders are everywhere to be seen abroad in the early mornings, trundling barrow-loads of soil to fill the holes in churchyards left by the night's resurrectionists, then that, you may think, is a deplorable state of affairs, and one to be remedied rather than further condoned. Nor should you think it a mitigating circumstance that the prisoner was enjoined to his ghoulish trade and remunerated, therefore, by an academical gentleman from Cambridge of scientific bent. Academical gentlemen do not stand above the law, and it may well be that consideration elsewhere of some aspects of the evidence will curb and restrain the activities of scholars who circulate in your midst, recklessly exhorting you to malfeasance, torts, and felonies. As to the charge that the accused defrauded the London and North Eastern Railway Company of its proper revenues by the dispatch of bodies to Cambridge University as freight, instead of in the guard's van of a passenger train, thereby effecting an improper economy, you may think that that is a trivial charge, but it is nevertheless one on which you are required to find. But it is in the charge of sacrilege that the burden of the case resides, And you may take the view that that is no laughing matter.
15 years, he gave old Joe Bug.
Oh, and old Joe hadn't dug half a dozen up in his lifetime. Poor old Joe.
And folk blame thee, Otto. They say thou put the police on his tail.
Rubbish. Why should I wish to see the old gentleman sent to break stone?
Another of thy pranks. Another of thy pranks.
No.
Otto Briggs was notorious in the district as a practical joker, with a knack for capping his jokes by diverting punishment onto other people. At 10, he'd planted a dead stoat in the schoolmaster's lunchbox, and another in the desk of a gamekeeper's son, and sat chortling among the tombstones after school as the lad yelped through a caning. As a youth, he'd got the verge of the sack by releasing a cage full of rats in the church organ. In middle age, he got an inquisitive police inspector posted by planting a mixed bag of poached hares and pheasants in the back of his car.
Aye, that can laugh, Otto. But he's a stern one, this judge. If he gives Joe Bug 15 years for digging the odd one up, with what would he requite some of thy pranks and pleasantries?
2 bitters and a Guinness.
Did you keep the room on, Crank?
No, going over to the salamander.
You know, they're still not letting.
The procession was yesterday.
That's the answer I got. Better ask here.
Sweetie, do you have any rooms for tonight?
That's the one you had last night.
What, just the one?
How many rooms do you normally sleep in?
Well, that depends on the company.
We don't have that kind of company here.
Away.
Most eerie silence in this place. Logs sizzling and sound of kitchen utensils somewhere distant. No guests, apparently, except self.
On account of your quietude, Your Honor. Shoved him away and barred the doors.
Did Mr. Justice Robinson insist?
Only in his latter days, sir, when he got old and put off his stroke by uproar.
Well, yes, quite understandably. But if my needs may be met in the privacy of these apartments, there is no reason why you should not conduct your normal trade. You may discover you have a legal obligation so to do.
Oh, then I shall comply forthwith and immediately. You see in me a stout upholder of the law, Your Honor.
And forthwith nipped across the square to the other pub and mustered a gathering of his customers, whom he then proceeded to present to me in the bar as though it were a huge joke, just as he presented his brother and dogs yesterday.
Mr. Frank Greenhouse, a traveller in nostrums for man and beast alike. George Blunstone, Esquire, outfitter. Mr. Samuel Kendall's feed and feeds. Mr. Alvin Sheeroff, farm machinery. Mr. Harry Roscoe, chemist in the market square. Mr. Grant, of Messrs. Woolworth, likewise situated. Captain Wilfred Creek, foreign, retired.
Rather embarrassing at first, some of them having been unnecessarily deprived of their beds because of me. But be nice and sociable. Pleasant change from council all day and old Willie Wotherspoon last night. Captain Creek, fine gentleman, served under poor Bertie at Jutland.
A great sailor, Bertie, and a great leader of men. Steadfast to the last. Absolutely calm as this torpedo came in our direction. Everyone on the bridge watching him, and all the faces upturned on the deck below, waiting for his order. Not a word. Then, the first lieutenant completely lost his head and called out, "Say something, sir, if only goodbye." And Bertie, without haste, and yet without hesitation, without taking his eye off the horizon, simply said, "Goodbye." Now that was leadership. And a fine example to all who survived.
Including, happily, yourself.
Including, happily, myself. Paddled back all the way across the North Sea on a raft, and when I was picked up in Yarmouth Roads by the Fraserburgh drifter Lot Sheil, I was so covered in oil, the skipper thought he'd caught a large sardine. Scottish humour. Now, I'd like you to meet Alvin Chayanov, sells cranes and things.
Farm machinery, Captain.
It was too late for the Salamander to start booking in overnight visitors, and Frank Greenhouse, George Blunston, and Alvin Chayanov again slept in the room Frank had booked at the Red Dragon. Frank insisted on taking his turn on the floor, and it was at some time during that second night that the uncomfortable economy of a shared room was spoken of as a deliberate policy.
You're a nice guy, Frank, and I sure hope you don't feel as sore tomorrow as I felt today.
Oh, that's all right.
Wake me at 3:30. I'll take my turn down there.
It's all right, George.
You know, the last time I did this...
It's not a habit, for Christ's sake, Alvin.
Look, we all came out of it with $250.
What did you do?
Well, this. We took a room for one, and then others just moved in.
How many?
12.
Where?
YMCA in Kansas Mo.
So you got $250 took to it?
No, we spent the winter in Miami.
Who?
All 12 of us. It ate into the savings. Cost us $27.50 each.
What? Same game?
Yes. But we ran into 16 other guys to share the cost.
Of what? He's telling you, George, of one room.
In the smartest hotel on Miami Beach.
28 of you moving. And only one registers and pays.
That's it.
That must be difficult to pull at a posh hotel in Miami.
Brother, nothing's difficult to pull anywhere if you pulled it in the YMCA in Kansas Mo.
Yeah, but how did you manage to sleep at 28 in a single room?
One of the guys we ran into knew yoga.
Oh.
An unlikely story told in a seedy hotel. And probably that's where it would all have ended if George Blunston's fortunes hadn't been suddenly and unforeseeably reversed. 4 miles out of Brigport, the coast road used to run along the top of a sea dike. George had left his car on the dike road and was talking in the doorway of a greenhouse to a nurseryman, a regular customer who bought 2 or sometimes 3 celluloid collars every 3 years.
Is your car all right, George?
Champion.
But it's moving, George,
isn't it? No, that's an optical illusion.
The handbrake. George, did you...
Good God. It is moving.
But by the time they reached the road, the car had run down the dike. It hit the sea and floated away, tugged by a gentle current.
Good God. All the air in the clothing gives such good insulation to the wearers, George. I would say that's what's now giving buoyancy to your vehicle.
Good God. Poor Hilde.
Filigree pattern of ice on carriage window,
the judge wrote to his wife.
Ditches all frozen over. Endless fields of snow, broken by the odd clump of bare trees stretching to indeterminate horizon where earth and sky merge in mist. The impressive landscape.
It was across this, the impressive landscape, in the slushy winter of 1936-37, that George Blunston shoved or hauled a handcart bearing his wares. His insurance company, the Permanent Probity, now defunct, had refused to pay up for his car, deeming its loss at sea to be an act of God. He dragged his handcart through slush and falling snow into the early darkness of winter afternoons, returning to Brigport by the light of stars, and making a half pint of beer last for what remained of the evening.
No, as I see it, it's rationalised my business and it's humanised me as a human being. I was aiming to be a Rothschild, a tycoon. Well, that's no kind of life. We weren't put on this earth for that. And what's more, Frank, I was going about it all the wrong way. I was making far too many calls. I was far too peremptory in my approach.
Yeah.
Well, now, when they offer me tea, I accept. Lady, this afternoon, tea cakes, jam, toast, apple pie, and then to crown it all, when I was going, she bought a pair of corsets for cash. Now, I was missing that kind of business. Had no time to pass with people, that car dehumanized me.
The other half, George.
Oh, thanks, Captain.
No.
Frank?
No, I'm okay.
And gobbling and guzzling as I am all day, I need no dinner when I get back. I eat like a horse, I work like a horse between the shafts, and I've never felt...
Oh, that's it. As regards points on the coast, George...
Yes.
Now, if I could be of any assistance, I should be delighted to put you ashore, together with your gear, and you could take them by surprise from the rear.
Sounds great tactics, Captain.
Yes, good training for the men. The thing is, regrettably, I'm not in a position to clear off the trousers.
I prefer your night and sweet, Captain, steadying.
The rest of your tally business,
Joe. Oh, let it lie. Keep me in me old age.
Snow fell heavily and melted, leaving farm tracks impassable and main roads up to 18 inches deep in slush. In 3 hours, George Blunston shoved his handcart 1 mile. Then he sat on the shafts till his sweat froze. He abandoned his cart and walked back to Bridport Parish Church and prayed for frost. The next day was, as requested, cold and hard, and in brilliant sunshine George steered his handcart along the frozen ruts, visiting nearly 20 farmhouses, taking £2.10 in cash, and returning to Bridport while the gas lamps were still pale against the light of the dying day. It was the manner of his return that moved events along. In those days, few roads were salted, and by late afternoon the cinders spread that morning on the cobbled street which drops into Bridport Market Square had been scattered by the passage of vehicles and frozen over. Frank Greenhalgh and Harry Roscoe at the window of Roscoe's chemist shop saw George Blunston coming over the brow, in his exhilaration, too quickly. The handcart ran away with him. Slithering and slipping, kicking out his legs and digging in his heels, he sped downhill, the handcart slewing and skidding in his desperate grasp. Dogs barked, children scattered, old ladies spoke rebukes, and George Blunston and his handcart shot straight through the plate-glass window of Harry Roscoe's shop.
Hello, George.
Harry. Frank.
George. Business booking up a bit.
Oh, can't grumble at all for the time of year.
A good day, Frank.
Oh, considering the time of the year.
And make much difference to you, Harry?
Oh, season, hard to say. We're up on Lloyd George prescriptions, but down on Frank's kind of jollop. But there again, the prescription patients are dying off all the time.
Perhaps then you might consider taking a few shrouds into stock, Harry.
I'd love to, George, particularly as you've gone out of your way to drop in.
Oh, not at all.
But Sweet and Treble, the funeral people, have a corner in them, and it's a small town, George.
Oh, quite understood.
They obtain their embalming fluid through me, though they could order it direct, so I wouldn't.
Of course, no. I'll see to the window and things tomorrow, Harry.
Not at all. Any time.
Three and a half bitters. Irene, what'll it be?
Oh, it's my round, Michael. You bought one last night.
Oh.
Frank?
No, thanks, Irene. I'll stay with this.
George?
Oh, I'm okay. No, thanks.
4 half bitters, please.
Mrs. Irene Thornber was the only woman in the changing group who on these winter evenings drank their dinner at the bar of the Salamander in slow half-pints. She was a travelling dressmaker, 30, plump, divorced, and radiant. She had the art of making women feel well about themselves, working round them in bare hired rooms with a mouthful of pins and standing back with such pleasure in her eyes that many countrywomen, now old, remember their wedding dress as having had a quality that completely escaped the lens of Harry Roscoe, farmer's chemist, and part-time photographer. On this particular evening, January the 13th, 1937, many of Harry's photographic plates lay shattered on the floor of his shop. George Blunston's abrupt entry was to cost him more than £100 in damages. It wasn't only a matter of the window. The handcart was wrecked, shelves, a display cabinet, and scores of bottles were smashed, and a pool of mingled medicines had dyed George's garments with evil-smelling stains.
Irene, how do you fancy a pair of rainbow-coloured toms? What'd she say?
She'd come for a fitting.
You've made it all worthwhile, love. What I shall do tomorrow, or what I shall endeavour to do tomorrow, I shall endeavour to lay my hands on a rucksack.
Travel light.
That's right, Captain. Cross-country.
Make a beeline.
Exactly.
The worst thing of all, I imagine, is to be bound to the roads.
Get it up on your rump, and you can go anywhere.
And as regards coastal points, speaking from a very limited experience, Dardanelles, I think the Barrow might have proved an embarrassment in the shallow.
Which is precisely why I've never availed myself of your kind offer. but with only a rucksack to consider.
Quite. Drop you off at some godforsaken point in the dead of night,
yes,
and you can wade ashore and catch them utterly by surprise from the rear.
Hey, three double whiskies, Otto, and send the marsala over to the young lady with my compliments.
Thank you.
The buoyancy and cheerfulness of the salesman which the judge enjoyed on the short visits he occasionally made to the bar sprang not from success, but from survival. George Blunston was obviously in the gravest straits.
Poor Hilda. Eh, she's a brick.
But in January 1937, the rest of the crowd that congregated in the bar of the Salamander were little better off.
But there must be the business. If you can find it.
There isn't, Michael. It isn't there to be found. All you can do is cut your expenditure and sit tight. We ought to form a stack.
What's that in the name of God?
American thing Alvin was on about.
Yeah, one guy pays for a room and the rest move in for free.
And why did you call it a stack?
Well, it's upheld by the discipline of yoga.
Glory be to God.
Double bed. Three guys lie side by side lengthways,
yeah.
Then four widthways across them, yeah. Then three more lengthways surmounted by another four across and so on.
Yeah, well, the kind of way you see timber stacked in woodyards.
Sure.
Dubious, George?
No, I believe it. It's all right for wogs and Americans, but it wouldn't do here.
It was, in fact, never attempted in that form. But the word stack came to be used of the practice of several persons sharing an hotel bedroom for which only one had paid. And it's still understood in this sense among reps in parts of eastern England. The first attempt, early in February 1937, was unplanned. It was the impetuous grasping of an opportunity, and ended badly.
I was really to blame.
Mr. Sam Swindles, the former feed and seed salesman, has written from Melbourne.
It was before my marriage, and I was then an immature and nervous young man, wearing plus fours and a little ginger moustache, which I later shaved off because people said it made me look like the Fuhrer. It was not at Brigport, but at Collingford, 30 miles inland, at a pub called the White Elephant, whose landlord had taken to drink and was out most days with his gun and dog, leaving the place to an old servant and the woodworm. A blizzard was raging, and hearing the landlord was snowbound somewhere out in the countryside, nine of us, having spent up on beer at a pub across the road, moved in to take advantage of his absence.
Among the nine were George Blunston, Frank Greenhouse, and Michael Riley, and Bob Bunker, a traveller in furniture who takes a vital part in later events. Alvin Chayanov was not present, and they made no attempt to dispose themselves about the small bedroom with any discipline or order. Three stretched out on the floor, one tried to make himself comfortable on a small dressing table, and the rest, having removed their top clothes, got in or on the single bed.
All right, everybody okay? Lights out.
Just...
Can you ease over at all, George?
Oh, give up, lad. I'm supporting myself with one hand on the floor already.
Sorry.
Sorry, lad. Sorry. It's just a tickle or something.
All right, all right, all right.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
Jesus, there, Angel. For God's sake, Bob.
Use your willpower, Bob. Stuff your wig in your mouth.
Not in my face, Bob. Not in my face.
Sorry, Sam.
Stop writhing, Bob. Just pick one spot and cough into it.
They're still broadcast.
What are
germs?
Oh, God, that must be better than a malarial swab.
I'm sorry, lad. I'm sorry.
You look... Just let me get me a... through to me samples, will you? Sorry.
Here,
on it. Just try a slug of that, then, will you, Bob?
What's the dose, Frank?
take a good slug.
Oh, that's a relief.
Drop a good stuff that, Frank. Harker's best line.
Thanks, Frank. I must buy a bottle of that.
Never fails.
What's it called?
Weed killer.
That's not right. That's not right.
Oh, God, save us. I could wake up in the morning and play them some dare.
Look, are we never going to get to sleep?
Bobbies.
That's not funny. That's not in good taste. If it finishes me off, I've got witnesses.
If it finishes you off, you won't need them.
People shouldn't be poisoned. No.
I repeat, are we never going to get to sleep?
It's gnawing at me vitals.
Then snuff it quietly, and everybody shut up.
What's that?
What's that? Good God! Landlord's come home!
Let me in! Let me in! Darling sir, you get to the home first on! Open up, you miserable sucker-ass barber!
What's it? Phil?
Ah. He slid down by the wall with his gun. And the dog's curling up with him.
Right then. Let's get to sleep.
While we are awake...
Get to sleep!
I must confess, Mr. Swindles has written, that it was I, not being accustomed to the volume of beer we had consumed, who was obliged to interrupt the slumber.
Excuse me. Excuse me, please, gentlemen. Gentlemen, please. Please, gentlemen. Wake up, I want to pee.
What the hell is it now?
It's only a natural function.
Boil it, Sammy Wolf.
I've been boiling it for an hour.
It's 2 o'clock.
Well, I tried to ask earlier, but you wouldn't...
Are we never going to get to sleep?
Well, let him out.
Let him out.
This is not restful. This is not repose.
Well, just let me get through to the door. If you wouldn't mind...
I would mind. Do it out of the window. Come on, quick. The snow's blowing in.
Go on, Sammy. Oblige.
You strut into them bastards! Piss on me from your own casement, would you?
The salesman escaped from the hotel by every possible egress, through doors and windows, up the chimney, down into the vaults, and up through the trap into the street. Some slithered along the roof and swarmed down drain spouts. Appearing from every side of the hotel, they raced into the blizzard, pursued by the landlord and his dog. They ran the length of the main street, dodging into shop doorways as the landlord fired. Then, hearing a coal train approaching through the night, they raced to the humpback bridge on the Brigport Road and leapt from the parapet into the wagons passing below.
Oh, anybody hit? Dog got a snap at me leg.
Oh, some fierce night to be travelling abroad, half-dressed.
Oh, it is parky, Frank, it is. Yes. Parky. I'd never have believed my own vest could have let the breeze through to the sixth end. Oh,
Life invariably wards me the dirty end of the stick.
I wouldn't say that, Bob. The cop you had last night might have killed you, but for his weed killer.
But the weed killer would have killed me.
But for the gunfire which roused you from your coma.
But the gunfire could have killed me.
If you hadn't leapt into the coal tree.
Which has brought my cough back. I've come full circle.
Frank, the weed killer.
It was around 9 o'clock. And they were in Ye Olde Coffee Shoppy in Brigport Market Square, thawing themselves out with gallons of Ye Olde Coffee and wolfing down buns, all paid for by Alvin Chayanov. In 3 days, against all odds, he'd sold a mowing machine, 2 binders, and 10 rakes. He slapped his money down on the counter like a prospector who has hit gold and said,
"There you are, Tootsie. Just say the word when we've eaten our way through that."
At Bridport Station, where they'd leapt from the train and rolled in the snow on the platform, Frank Greenhalgh had forced the door of the parcels office where George Blunston kept his small stock. Men caked in ice selected themselves a wardrobe of farming attire and lit a fire in the waiting room.
George's stock was sparse,
Mr. Sam Swindles has written.
His suits were all of the same medium size, so that Frank Greenhalgh's legs and arms stuck out, and I looked like a dwarf cocooned in cloth. We left the station early in order to keep out of the sight of any customers who came in on the first train.
And here again the story might have ended if Alvin Chayanov had not been at breakfast at one of the two window tables of the Salamander Hotel and noticed them skulking along past the bike shop on the other side of the square.
Jesus H. Christ, boys! You look like the advance guard of a circus. Where did you get that hat?
Well,
as
Jack said, threw it out the window.
And Sammy got up on the chair and just let
You'd have thought it was a horse.
More coffee, Michael.
Oh, that sounds right up well.
Only Bob Bunker stayed out of the fun, his cough returning and his cold resuming with such dripping force that George Blunston discreetly shifted the sugar bowl. Sammy Swindles had dark moments, too.
Oh, what'll I tell my mother?
What about?
My suit, losing it.
Tell her you lost it.
But she'll think I've been up to, you know.
Oh, an affair of the art.
Yeah, she'll belt me.
Stop her with a straight left, then.
Ah, no good. Women, they duck and weave.
Ah, well, put them together then, Sam. Shouldn't he, Frank?
What?
Pin his mother with the left and hook her with the right.
If he's not a southpaw.
Two ladies came in to buy cakes. The salesman stopped talking in deference to them, and when they'd gone, nobody knew how to resume. They'd been up all night, and now suddenly they were tired. Some had lost their money, some their samples, some their shirts, and several had lost the only decent pinstripe suit they possessed. The silence in ye olde coffee shoppy was the silence of men who were down and out, and so they came back, with the greatest reluctance, to the idea of room-sharing in a hotel. Somebody asked Alvin Chayanov how true his accounts of room-sharing in North America had been. He said in principle they were wholly true. There was a long silence, as Sam Swindle said long afterwards, of men who sensed they were sealing their fate. And by general consent they asked Alvin to show them how.
The question isn't how, but where.
Mm.
You've got to have a big place.
Yeah.
Now, the YMCA at Kansas Mo was okay. The swell hotels at Miami Beach were okay. We once tried it at a little dump in Medicine Hat, Alberta, and Jesus, they nearly killed us.
We want to avoid that.
You got to have a place so big, they just don't notice.
Yeah. Well, Alvin, the Salamander right here, it's not big.
36 rooms.
About that, but they don't know or care what goes on in them.
That's so. You meet all sorts of conditions roaming round the corridors before the light of dawn.
Poachers.
Horse dealers.
Whores.
Rotarians.
Everybody's camping in and out. They're up to their eyes in all sorts of rackets.
Okay. Okay. It might do. Give it a throw.
That'll give old Otto something to laugh about.
Okay, but just to make sure we're not the babies he's laughing at, don't talk. And don't let the wrong guys in.
We'll get the dirty end of the stick again.
The judge and the hangman. Another assize beginning.
God save us.
Alvin, when you say, don't let the wrong guys in.
I mean talking guys.
But in the States and Canada, you must have some pretty loquacious...
Yeah, work. We got them all right. But they sort of disappeared.
Disappeared, Alvin? Meaning?
Meaning, I don't know, George. Nobody asked.
The first stack was formed at the Salamander Hotel Bridport on the night of February the 16th, 17th, 1937. Alvin Chayanov booked a room with a double bed, and while the company declined to be stacked up on it in the manner taught by the student of yoga at Miami Beach, some of them did learn from Alvin the discipline to sleep peacefully packed like sardines on the mattress. Others chose armchairs or stretched out on an eiderdown on the linoleum. The companionship lightened the spirits of men during the months of winter adversity.
And there was this Jewish woman in Montreal.
In Montreal.
And her friend said, "Your three boys, wie geht es mit them?"
How goes it with them?
And she said, "My oldest son, big producer in the movies, he make $1 million a year."
$1 million a year.
"And my second son, big surgeon in Victoria, B.C., he make $500,000.
$500,000.
"And my third son, he's a rabbi right here in Montreal. He makes $3,000. And her friend said, $3,000?
What kind of a job is that for a Jewish boy?"
"You shouldn't tell that joke, Alvin. It might be offensive to somebody."
"Might be. It is."
"To whom?"
"To me."
"To you?"
"That lady was my mother."
"Oh, no."
"And I made out so bad that I didn't even get into the joke."
The noises that came from the secret plural occupancy of the room at the Salamander were attributed by Abraham Briggs to the supernatural.
"The disturbed create disturbance. The exhumed seek return to the clay."
A fear received by his brother in the usual manner.
"I think Otto Briggs may have had a suspicion about us quite early on,"
Mr. Swindles has written.
"But he made his money out of the bar and such things as horse stealing and poaching, and he had very little interest in the accommodation side. His expense on the room was no greater than if it had been occupied by only the registered guests, and what we scoffed in bucksheep breakfasts he more than made up by increased bar sales and the odd dinner we bought. If he did suspect anything, he was shrewd enough to know this. At any rate, we felt increasingly secure, and several of us invested in inflatable mattresses."
"Okay, then, for lights out?"
"Yeah, okay, Frank.
Anytime. This Wayside Pulpit in Liverpool."
"Wayside what?"
"Wayside Pulpit. The placards they put up outside churches."
"Go on."
"Well, it said, what would you do if Jesus came tomorrow?
And
somebody wrote below, move Tommy Lawton to inside right." And this other one, it said, if you finished with sin, come in.
And
somebody wrote, if you haven't, ring Moss Side 0734.
"Who's there?"
"Irene
Thornburg." "Oh. Hold on, Irene. Keep it quiet, boy." "Irene?"
"Alvin?"
"I want to keep till morning, Irene."
"Tonight's sleep can't keep till tomorrow morning, Alvin."
"What do you want, Irene?"
"I want to join the sack."
"Shh. All right, come in.
Can we have the light on?" "Frank, George, Sammy, Bob, Michael,
Irene,
Harry.
Irene.
Thought you'd be all tucked up above your chemist shop, Harry."
"Oh, I drop over for a game of blow football."
"I'm sorry she turned you out again, Harry."
"Aye."
"Right, boys, where do I sleep?"
"Oh, no, women. Women talk."
"Men talk, Bob, or I wouldn't have known where to find you now."
"Are you broke, Irene?"
"Alvin, I wouldn't come here for the sake of my health."
"Move over, George."
"Certainly." "Oh, my God. Get out your glass with your elbow. It's got me teeth in."
Okay, love.
"Fine. Can we have a window open?"
"What? Oh, yeah. Anything to please a lady."
"Look, I've got a cold. We've never had the window open before."
"That's why you've got a cold."
"Well, she hasn't been here 5 seconds. She's changing the room."
"Bob, there are no rules."
There should be. It should be codified."
"Oh, God's sake.
There should be some form of constitution."
Okay. "Tomorrow. Now let's get to sleep." "Good night, Bob."
"Good night."
"Night, Frank."
"Good night, Alvin."
"Good night, Harry."
Good night, George.
Good night, Irene.
Good night, Irene.
Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dreams.
All right. Keep your hands to yourself.
But not me, Irene.
Not me.
Like a pack of schoolboys, you ought to be put to bed in boxing gloves.
All right, everybody. Lie on your hands.
Okay, Irene.
Okay. And Harry, just remember you're a married man, eh?
Last Saturday night I got married. Me and my wife settled down. Me and my wife are now papied. I'm gonna take the stroll downtown.
Okay, boys. Good night.
Irene, good night, Irene. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I'll see you.
Oh, all right. Let's have the light on. Right. Speak up. Who wants to make a proposition?
Not me, Irene. I'm a happily married man and living in Retford.
That's never stopped you rapping my door handle as you go past. Good old Frank, I think. There goes a real rep. Never miss a call. You never know your luck. Well, Harry?
Oh, not me, Irene. I'm a humble farmer's chemist, resident above the shop.
And who was it last time she turned you out? Proposed a long weekend in Cleethorpes?
Oh,
George?
Oh, not me, Irene. I'm too old, Murray.
George, you're the only suitor in all my life who's ever offered me a ride on a handcart on a winter night.
Hey, Sammy. Sammy, we haven't heard from you.
Oh, no.
Hey, Sammy. You've gone as red as a beet. Irene, I do believe he nurtures a secret passion for you.
No, let me help.
Oh, I've got it!
This is your chance, Sammy. This is your chance, lad. Say it. Now, spit it out.
Well, it's right, Irene. I have a passion. I think of nothing else. I reroute my course to be where you're working. My mind's not on my seeds. I forget my samples. I burn my mother's toast.
It's better to marry than to burn, as the good saint said, scraping his toast.
Is that what you intend, Sammy?
Well, yes.
Not just a long weekend at Cleethorpes.
Oh, no, no.
Nor a ride on a hay cart.
Hand cart.
No cart.
That's a start.
Never part.
From this night hence.
Gentlemen, let us leave the young people to themselves. Let us retire to the station waiting room.
Just a minute. We're not talking about a one-night tumble.
No, he's not very big for that, is he? But active, aren't you, Sam? Active as a rattlesnake.
We're talking about marriage, aren't we?
Holy wedlock.
Yes.
Because if we're not, say so.
No. On a proper basis.
Right. On a proper basis. I was married when I was 19, fat, soft, and daft. I worked round these counties.
You did, Irene?
I shovelled my share into the happy home, and then what happened? He sold the whole bag of tricks over my head, pocketed the winnings, and did a bunk with a pacifist schoolteacher and joined the Peace Pledge Union.
Oh. So what she wants, Sammy, you see, is a firm pledge not to join the Peace Pledge Union.
What I want, Sammy, is a firm statement of your assets. I have £53 in Martin's bank at Grantham.
Can you match that, Sam? What have you got in the bank?
Well, nothing. My mother looks after it.
all right, now. This is serious. But the house you live in, Sammy?
At Ipswich.
Is it rented, or do you own it?
Not exactly.
Well, come on, Sam, now. Does it belong to your mother?
Well, no.
Who does it belong to, then?
The parrot.
Hey, Irene, you sure as hell don't want to wind up in a parrot's cage, even if he is going to be as active as a rattlesnake.
Keep out of it, will you? Go on, Sammy.
Well, my grandfather did it to spite my grandmother. He left it to the parrot for the rest of its natural life, and the It's now about 160 years old.
That's no obstacle, Sam. We'll throttle your parrot. Oh,
God, Sam.
But then it passes to Mother.
We'll throttle your mother.
George, but I mean, what kind of a start is it for Irene to be carried over the threshold with a parrot, feet up on the bottom of its cage, and the bridegroom's mother sprawled out with a neck crack?
Unromantic, to say the least.
Romance is not what I'm looking for this time round. I'm looking for an honest man. Sammy, you're on.
Okay, fellas. Let's move out.
Right. Stay where you are. Take a week, Sammy, and think it over soberly.
Yes, Irene.
And if you're still of the same mind, we'll have the marriage ceremony first, in the old-fashioned way.
Yes, Irene.
And please, not in a registry office.
Thus it happened that Irene Thornber and Sammy Swindles were married, beyond the range of the older Mrs. Swindles, at sea, a ceremony conceived in the romantic mind of George Blunston, and urged by him upon the dubious Captain Creek.
Now, burial? That I have done. Mm. I'd be much happier about a burial.
But unhappily, Captain, we've no corpse.
That is a snag. I see that. But marriage, you see, there was seldom, if ever, the occasion for it in His Majesty's ships.
It is regarded in some quarters as a happier ceremony than a burial.
Yes, I've heard that said.
So if you could possibly just widen your scope, Captain. It is within your competence outside the 3-mile limit.
You're a persuasive fella, George.
Mm?
Your business, eh? All right. Good training for the men. Almighty God, who at the beginning did create our first parents, Adam and Eve, and did sanctify and join them together in marriage, pour upon you the riches of his grace, sanctify and bless you, that you may please him both in body and soul, and live together in holy love unto your life's end.
Amen.
Slow ahead, Mr. Blowcock.
Slow ahead, sir.
Gentlemen, the bride and bridegroom.
Bride and bridegroom.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you all.
The success of the marriage seems naturally, if not quite logically, to have confirmed Captain Creek's confidence in his legal powers, with consequences that were quite unforeseeable. The practice of room-sharing saw the salesmen through the winters and enriched them in summertime. They became so well known in the comings and goings of undefined people at the Salamander Hotel that the wangle became, if anything, easier to pull off with the passing seasons.
Voices in the night, Otto.
Wassailers, Abraham.
The exhumed come back to croon.
I know who croons.
Who croons, then? Name the crooners.
Not to thee.
Well, why not to me?
Thou too immature.
I'm but 3 minutes less aged than thee.
Then go and see who croons. Thou superstitious. Thou scared stiff.
thou takes after Grandfather Briggs, Otto. He was a clever scoffer like thee, but by God, he stopped laughing in the Valley of the Shadow. He died in a muck sweat, fearing himself for dissecting slab at Cambridge worse than hell.
Hey, I had an unfestive visit this afternoon.
Who on, Bob?
Afternoon, I'm saying, but it got to evening.
You don't say.
And I'd only had a piece of Stilton for me lunch.
Better on a light lunch.
I'd accomplished the business in 15 minutes. Then he went on and on about his son. He got this degree and that degree, and he could have been a water engineer somewhere, but he went into sewage somewhere else. And the time was passing, and everybody was getting their coats. Good night, good night. This person and that person going home.
Very boring, Bob.
Exactly. My belly rumbling and him droning on about his son.
That's horrible tedious.
Swansea was where they'd offered him the job.
Very boring.
But the streets were too steep for his wife to push a pram.
It's boring. Stop it.
Oh. That's the point I'm making, Frank. He was boring me.
All right, well, you're boring us.
Yeah. I don't bore people. I have a son manager of a jute plantation in Tanganyika, but I don't go around...
All right, well, stop it. Shut up.
I didn't want to stand there without my dinner, listening to stories about not pushing prams up hills in Swansea.
Bob, you're dealing in double, triple, and quadruple negatives.
Well, what does that mean?
It means, for Christ's sake, shut up.
I'm not wanted, then.
No.
I... No.
Right.
What are you doing there, then?
Letting my Lilo down. And I'm going.
Hear that, Otto?
A loose door banging.
And footsteps. The departed depart. The exhumed return to the clay.
The rift between Bob Bunker and the rest was never properly healed, but importunity compelled him to go back to the shared room, and he was with them in the bar on the fateful night of May the 17th, 1939. Neither of the Swindles was present, and Alvin was out late. The rest were drinking with an occasional crony, the local police inspector Fred Forage, who that night was inquiring, but not too diligently, about a Dutch salesman who had gone missing in the vicinity.
Hawking drainage system, yes. Last seen getting off the midday bus from Boston. That's his picture.
No,
Fred.
No, never seen him.
Okay. What are you drinking? George, half a bit of it. Frank, Michael, Bob, same again.
Oh, please, not for me.
4 half bitters and a Guinness, Otto.
For me.
And, won't you have a lemonade, Bob?
All right, thanks.
And a half for yourself and your brother.
Thank you, Inspector.
Otto, I'm making inquiries about a Dutchman called Van der Linden. Ooh. Ever seen a man who looked like that?
Portraits, sir. I can't rightly describe without spectacles, as soon as I've drawn the ale. What is thought to have befallen the gentleman?
At one extreme, murder.
A black crime in Spain. And at the other?
Perhaps just done a bunk from the happy home.
That, in its way, is dastardly too, sir.
Otto!
I am serving Abraham. Three to left, Inspector Forrest. Oh. Sure. Now, if I can put me windows on the portrait.
Otto.
No, sir, I never saw the gentleman.
Oh, well, thank you, Otto.
Perhaps my brother. Can you manage to send yourself in?
Yes, fine.
Abraham, did you ever see a Dutch gentleman of this description?
What is it? It's young Eddie Bog, George's nephew.
What of him?
He's brought us a fresh one.
A fresh one? We've never handled fresh ones.
I told him we don't handle fresh ones.
Take it away, tell him. Yeah, take it away.
I told him, but he dumped it inside the back door and ran. Oh. And the police here questioning him, they hewed crying, for all we know, watching the exits from every point of vantage.
All right.
We could swing.
Calm down. Dump it in the vault. I'll come later. No, Inspector Forrest, sir, my brother. That has an inscrutable memory for faces, has not seen the unfortunate or erring gentleman.
Oh, thank you, Otto. Hello, Alvin. What'll you have?
Now it's my round. I just sold a tractor.
Tractors is the wonderful vehicle I hear. Do you believe it will one day displace the horse as man's best friend?
Well, in time, I guess, Otto, it will. Okay, boys, drink up. We're on shorts. What's it gonna be?
Yeah. If I may be so bold, Mr. Chayonov, sir, to mark this happy and festive occasion, may I offer a drop of my grandfather's 1879.
Oh.
The old gentleman might not always have been quite the right side of the law, but there, sir. You're Irish with a civilized palate. What do you say?
Irrigation for the soul.
Albert.
Yes, Inspector?
Before everybody gets drunk, routine inquiry. Did you ever see this man?
No, I guess not. Why should I?
Oh, he was a salesman. You might have run into him. Perhaps somewhere in your travels, shared a room with him.
Why in hell did you think I share rooms, Fred?
Mr. Chiarnoff doesn't share rooms, Inspector.
No, routine inquiry. No offence intended.
Yeah. Okay, none taken.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, gentlemen, if I may be so bold as to propose a toast to all of you and to the future of the tractor.
As the evening wore merrily on,
Inspector Forage wrote many years later,
I grew, to quote the bard, unpregnant of my cause. I lost the photograph of Van der Linden, and retained only sufficient of my wits to stumble home by a devious route designed to avoid patrolling constables.
The salesmen, for their part, found their way to their room, and flaked out without troubling to blow up their mattresses. In the morning, Bob Bunker, who had stuck to lemonade, was first up. He stepped across someone sprawled out by the door, and went to take the cold bath, which, against all his experience, he believed to be efficacious in warding off head colds. The sound of the cold tap drummed into heads throbbing with the vapours of the 1879 poutine.
Oh, holy mother of God.
What time is it?
It's 7:20.
Bob's
running his cold bath.
God, please. Who's that flaked out by the door, then?
Mm-hmm. Some guy, I guess.
Get him up, Frank, to him.
Why?
Well, I'll tell him to get up, sunshine. Wakey.
Who is he, then?
Search me. You've never been here before.
Wakey, rise and shine.
George, I have a feeling this one is not going to rise and shine.
Who is he? His face seems familiar.
In the bar. Last night. On Inspector Forage's photograph.
Is it the part of his, then?
It is.
Oh, God have mercy on us all.
And ours.
Providence and mercy stir us all.
All right.
Mary, Mother of God, preserve
us. All right, Michael. Everything in due course.
How did he get there? I don't know. But I've got a hunch who might. And I'm going right down to see him.
Good morning, Mr. Chiarnoff, sir. Down!
What are you doing snooping around here?
Exercising the hounds along the corridor, sir. And I was attracted by uproar. Is anything the missive?
What's this dead guy doing here?
That I couldn't say, sir. Nor could I explain the number of the living present.
Okay, present your bill.
For the night, sir, or for the past 2.5 years.
Okay, Otto, okay, for the past 2.5 years. Now get your corpse the hell out of here.
How did I have... My dogs, not my corpse, sir. I have no truck with corpses.
You planted him last night. He's a Dutch guy the cops were questioning you about.
And they were questioning you too, sir. Suspicion falls on everyone at a time like this.
You planted him when we were all high. Yeah. You traffic in him. Horses, pheasants, stiffs. It's one of your occasional rackets.
Back at him!
And this guy, he was just too hot a potato to handle with the cops around, so you planted him on us. Yeah. It's your stock joke.
And yours, sir. You all planted yourselves on me.
Okay, but we don't plant stiffs.
Nor me, sir, God forbid.
Oh, well, you see what I tell the cops.
They may take your word, Mr. Chiarnoff, sir, but equally they may come to the view that the traveling Dutch gentleman arrived to join your stack, do you call it, sir, and passed on during the night of natural causes, or, for reasons I will not hazard, met a more untimely end.
This is a frame-up. I'm going to call a cop.
You might, Mr. Chiarnoff, sir, but you might, on reflection, consider it more prudent for all concerned to arrange a privy and reverent send-off.
And so, according to her log, Captain Creek's launch sailed from her mooring at Brigport at 10:07 GMT on May the 18th, 1939, carrying the body of Johan van der Linden, bagged up in one of George Blunston's shrouds, and with a company of four travelling salesmen on deck wearing new black ties. Bob Bunker had declined to take part in the proceedings, he alone having doubted the prudence of the privy and reverent send-off recommended by Otto Briggs.
In life, in death, O Lord, abide with me.
Here, at this point, my Captain Bertie Banks used to say a good word or two for the chap.
Ah, that would be welcome, Captain.
Yeah, but not having the pleasure of the chap's acquaintance, you see my pickle.
Well, he was a man who, what would you say, Grant?
He was a man. We shall not look upon his like again.
That's awfully good. If you think, Frank.
Oh, by all means, Captain, we are in your hands.
Well, then, this poor chap that slipped off in the night, he was a man we shall not, what was it?
Look upon his like again.
Yeah, quite. Look upon his like again.
Yeah. Leave him in the hugging, sir.
Wait for it, Mr. Bloder, wait for it. For as much as it had pleased Almighty God of his great mercy to take unto himself the soul of our dear brother here departed, we therefore commit his body to the sea, earth to earth, water to water, dust to sand, in sure and certain hope of resurrection to eternal life. Heave-ho, Mr. Bloder!
Heave-ho, sir!
Start engines, Mr. Bloder!
Start engines, sir!
Thank you, Captain. My pleasure, gentlemen. Pull ahead, Mr. Bloder.
Pull ahead, sir.
And, Captain, there's no danger the deceased might drift back.
Not in the least. When I paddled back from Jutland, it was against the prevailing current, as I made clear in my letter to the Daily Telegraph of January the 18th, 1924.
Might distress the relatives.
No, rest assured, Callum. He'll be halfway down the channel by now. Pitch up, no doubt, in some happy tropical clime. Get a bit of sun into his marrow, what?
The spring of 1939 turned into a fine summer. Fine and the most prosperous since the First World War. It's often forgotten now, Mr. Sam Swindles has written, but to those of us in trade, it was a bright year. Irene and I bought a little Ford van, and its shared use enabled us, by increasing our total calls, to work pretty much the same territories at the same time. We had a very happy summer together, and some very enjoyable motor rides round the dusty lanes of Lincolnshire. The stack was finished, and the boys paid for separate rooms. But only Bob Bunker left the Salamander and returned to the Red Dragon. He was, as we discovered, at odds with the boys. And summer was a bad time for him as a furniture salesman. The others boomed. George was able to invest in a rucksack with a steel frame to carry his goods.
It's the best invention since sliced bread. I can carry half a cartload in this and still finish the day walking on air.
Alvin sold a large number of mowing machines, 13 binders, and two more tractors. Michael always did well with his sweets in the resorts in summer, and the hypochondria which had seen Frank through the leaner years of the 30s began to pile up commission for him in 1939.
And here, Harry, we have got a spanking new cure-em-all. Instant relief from rheumatism and flatulence, dandruff and paranoia, a remedy for strains, sprains and aches of every kind, a sure cure for measles, dipsomania, swine fever and foot and mouth disease. 13 to the dozen, Harry. I'll put you down for a gross.
Splendid journey out to Brigport,
the judge wrote home.
Carts moving along the dyke roads laden with quantities of peas. Women working in strawberry fields as far as the eye can see. Bumper haycrop, I should think.
The Variety Theatre in Brigport had been transformed into a dance hall, and the old bike shop next door had blossomed into a milk bar, where the salesmen sometimes met on summer evenings. Apart from old Bob Bunker, Mr. Swindles has written, everyone was in the highest spirits. The salamander had quite a few holiday visitors, and old Otto was fairly chortling and joking.
Otto, what do I owe you?
£1,427, sir.
Okay, okay. Think up a new crack.
£22 sir, and in truth, none of you knights of the road owes me nothing. In bad times, your kind patronage kept the bar busy and the whole place a bustle. My benighted brother wouldn't see it, sir, and he might strangle the lot of you if matters came to his ears. But in this life, Mr. Chionov, sir, one good turn deserves another. What we lose is on the swings, we gains on the roundabouts. Any more for sailing?
For the men with whom this account is concerned, the bright summer was about to end.
Hello, copy desk. Rawnsley, Mablethorpe. Catch line, stiff. Bathers and holidaymakers on the seafront here today were surprised when a male body aged about 45 was washed ashore and deposited within 10 yards of a busy whelk stall.
Are you making it up, Frank? Have the other half.
Oh, I'm not. It's here in the paper.
Oh, my God, it is.
Well, read on, Frank.
Right, the body is not thought to have gone swimming, as it was attired in a continental suit and a cheap shroud.
A cheap shroud?
Guaranteed to last a lifetime and obtainable exclusively from George Funston Family Outfit.
Hey, for Christ's sake, you guys, this is serious.
Yeah, that's what it says, Elvin. This is serious, stated a police spokesman. Foul play cannot be ruled out.
Those bastards said the current ran the other way.
Now listen, this isn't our boy. We know nothing.
Hello, Irene Lou. What are you at?
Oh, my father, please, George.
Ah.
What's wrong, boy? What have you been up to?
Oh, nothing, Irene. Nothing. Master, three double whiskies and a Guinness, please.
We can state nothing at this juncture, the police spokesman stated. We appeal to members of the public to come forward with information.
The appeal did not fall on deaf ears. Bob Bunker, eager to avoid being hanged in error, sought out their friend Inspector Forage and made a statement. He was encouraged in his belief that there was a device known as turning King's evidence by which one immunized oneself from prosecution, and he was allowed to stress that he was absent and about his ablutions when the body was discovered, and that he had refrained from participating in its disposal. Inspector Forage plied him with cigarettes and cups of tea, obligingly lent him his thick-barreled fountain pen obtained with Horniman's tea coupons to sign with, then arrested him, deprived him of his tie and braces, and locked him up. In return, Bob Bunker infected Inspector Forage with a bad cold, which, however, did not develop fast enough to incommode him in the night's business.
Did I ever tell you the one about the two flies?
Frank, you've told me nothing else.
Oh, thanks, but I prefer a Guinness.
They were playing football in a saucer.
Yes, yes, and one said to the other.
We have to do better than this, don't we?
We are playing in the jug.
I'm a police officer. Frank Dalwimple Greenouch, Michael O'Donovan Riley, George Blunston, Alvin Moses Choyanov, I arrest you for the murder of Johan van der Linden. You're not obliged to say anything, but anything you do say, it'll be taken down in writing and may be given in evidence.
A marsala for the young lady, please, Otto.
You make it two for the beautiful young lady.
The Queen of the Eastern Counties. Make it three.
I'll make it four, for Christ's sake. What's the difference?
And now, if you'd please accompany
okay,
me...
Okay, okay, Buster. Good night, Irene.
Good night, Harry.
Good night, Irene.
Good night, Irene.
Good night.
Usual tedious trapping,
the judge wrote to his wife.
Procession through Market Square, then harangued as usual in church by old Willie Wotherspoon.
We eat and
drink our own damnation. We kindle God's wrath against us. We provoke him to plague us with diverse diseases and sundry kinds of death. Judge therefore yourselves, brethren, that ye be not judged of the Lord.
Must be getting old, have never looked upon a trial with so much misgiving.
The story of the trial is generally known, and in this program the evidence has already been extensively drawn upon in the course of reconstructing the events. What is new and illuminating is the comment made by the judge in letters to his wife of the prosecuting counsel, Leonard Limpet, K.C., who later became a junior minister at the Board of Trade. The judge wrote,
"Nasty little smart aleck has put it about not proceeding with any charges of conspiracy to defraud hotels. Jurors, being local tradesmen and such like, made indignant, and will turn whole venom on chaps who are in the dock."
Among the many travellers who might have been but were not put on trial for defrauding hotel keepers were Mr. and Mrs. Sammy Swindles, to whom we are indebted for the light they've thrown on the story. They sold the house at Ipswich after the death of both the parrot and Mrs. Swindles Sr. in 1948, and emigrated on the proceeds to Australia, where they established a travel agency in Melbourne. Of the six accused, one, Captain Creek, charged with being an accessory after the fact, was set at liberty, with the concurrence of the Crown. The judge told him,
"You have been a fool rather than a knave, as perhaps befits your rank and service."
Captain Creek was, in fact, recalled to the Royal Navy shortly after the outbreak of war, and given command of a destroyer. He went down with all hands, still wearing the trousers supplied by George Blunston, and carrying in his pocket a photograph taken many years earlier of a woman, then young, Caroline Winstanley, of Halifax, Nova Scotia. The remaining five accused departed with less glory. The jury, insular men of Brigport, wrathful at the outsiders who had fraudulently battened in their midst, were clearly determined to allow no one else to escape, and Leonard Limpet, K.C., played on the prejudice.
"Now, come, Mr. Blunston. Do you think it a fitting end to be dumped at sea? Is it an end you would choose for a loved one?"
"If it was done with due decorum."
"Was it decorous to bag up a man you claim you did not know, to bag him up in a shoddy shroud and have him heaved overboard by drunken sailors?"
"The sailors were not drunken."
"That is what you call decorous. It is decorous to bury a body with fitting ceremony. In some avant-garde quarters, it is even deemed decorous to cremate a body."
"Gentlemen of the jury, please do not give way to expressions of mirth. It is most improper. Mr. Limpet?"
"I was proceeding, Your Honor, to the view that it was not only decorous but laudable to dispose of a body to the competent medical research authority."
"Gentlemen of the jury, please—" "What sort of a trial is this, Your Honor? The whole jury are body snatchers to a man."
Not from that.
It's a staple local industry. The offence isn't that a man is dead, but that a body has been dumped in the sea, book she, instead of being freighted to Cambridge for the usual rate."
Sir,
George Blunston, that is a most improper accusation. It is outrageous.
Sure, Your Honor.
But, gentlemen of the jury, you must not show assent or dissent. You are here to try a case, not to act as a clerk. Could you not, please, Mr. Limpet, pursue a more relevant line?"
"But the line was only too relevant,"
the judge wrote to his wife that night.
"Jury sat back with narrow eyes of men who have been doubly outraged and will be revenged. Hobson for defense labors away at point that unlawful disposal does not imply guilt of murder. But how else explain it? Post-mortem shows chap was strangled. By whom, if not by them?"
The question remains unanswered to this day. No evidence was given of the vital link to the truth, the visit of Eddie Bogg to the back door of the Salamander Hotel on the night of May the 17th. It was only spoken of 16 years later, in 1955, by Abraham Briggs, on his deathbed. By then Otto was already dead, and Eddie Bogg had been drowned fishing off Cromer. The judge's letter to his wife continues with some insight.
"Convinced that old devil Otto Briggs knows more than he lets on. Too bland altogether, I thought, in witness box, laughing off rather wild accusations of the accused. I do go on, darling Bobsey, don't I? But the thing is, I know these chaps and believe what they say. That they found the chap dead, thought it looked V-black for them, and simply dumped him. They're slap-happy people, and I suppose to a dry stick like me, it's their charm. But it's not V-credible, and smart Alex defeats them at every turn.
But of course, you've previous experience, Mr. Chernoff.
Of organizing room sharing, yes.
And of getting rid of people?
No.
You see, Mr. Bunker, who is accused along with you, has given evidence that you spoke of persons who might join in your swindle and subsequently gossip about it. Guys who talked, I think was the phrase. Did you speak of guys who talked?
Well, I may have.
And what did you say happened to them?
I don't know what happened to them.
Did you not say, and again I quote Mr. Bunker, they just disappeared?
I may have.
And is Mr. Bunker again right in saying that in reference to these disappearances, you use the cryptic phrase, nobody asked?
Could be.
And why did nobody ask, Mr. Chernoff?
I guess because they just didn't ask.
But the phrase imported more than that, did it not?
No.
It did not carry a suggestion of menace?
No.
It would be quite wrong to infer that to ask about these disappearances would be imprudent and even unsafe.
No. Yes. I got lost in the double negatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chernoff.
Should all be over tomorrow,
the judge wrote that night.
I shall instruct jury in usual things, beyond a reasonable doubt, mistrust, circumstantial evidence, etc. But the writing is on the wall, or rather on jury's faces. Jurisprudence never so disagreeable to me. I wonder if war comes, would the army have me back? Very tired tonight. Deep instinct, finding will be wrong, but unexceptionable in law.
The jury fulfilled the judge's fears, and at 4:15 on the following afternoon he pronounced sentence.
The sentence of the court upon you is that you be taken from this place to a lawful prison, and thence to a place of execution, and that you there suffer death by hanging, and that your body be afterwards buried within the precincts of the prison in which you shall have been confined before your execution. And may the Lord have mercy on your soul.
The five men, George, Frank, Alvin, Michael, and Bob Bunker, the poor man's Judas, as Alvin forgivingly called him, stayed overnight at Brickport Police Station. They were visited by the bishop, the Right Reverend William Wotherspoon, who brought them cakes, comfort, and tidings from the outside world.
And the Germans have attacked Poland.
So the balloons gone up?
Alas, I always think war is so very disagreeable. Things get rationed, and one has to take one's tea and sugar in a little screw of paper when one goes visiting.
What terrible privation, Your Reverend.
So, if it must be that...
Sure, we won't miss much in the way of tea parties.
Exactly. So, that's good, isn't it? Mm. And George?
Yes.
My chaplain has been on to the permanent property insurance.
Oh, what did they say?
They will pay on your life policy.
Oh, that's champion.
Thank you, Bishop.
Hilda will be pleased.
The prison authorities will give her the certificate as soon as notice of your execution is posted on the gate.
That's lovely. That's champion.
I thought you'd like to know. So, all sorts of good things, really, to keep the decker up.
Next morning, the five men were driven the few hundred yards to Brickport Station, where the puffing little engine had been coupled to a barred guard's van. Only Captain Creek and the Swindles were allowed on the platform. A crowd, including Harry Roscoe the chemist and some members of the jury, were at the paling fence, a line of faces above the wilting flowers in the platform garden. Otto and Abraham Briggs watched from a high back window in the Salamander Hotel. The station master wore full dress uniform and medals.
Right away!
The train moved out into the countryside of Lincolnshire, across the dikes, under the humpbacked bridges, through fields where the harvest was turning gold, beneath a sky filling with growing banks of cumulus cloud, round which the first of the war's little aeroplanes bounced about with engines like sewing machines.
Holy Mary, Mother of God,
Pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee.
I suppose it could have come at a worse time.
You think so, George?
Oh, yes. I'd had enough of humping that pack around on me back.
That sure is one way to take the weight off your feet.
You'd have done no business in wartime, Frank.
With my experience of horse pills, I'd have been a cavalry officer.
Ah, but when it was over, Frank, coming back to the horse pills, how would you face a drop like that?
Somewhat better than the drop I'm facing now.
I always knew we'd wind up with the dirty end of the stick.
Oh, cheer up! One thing you can say about hanging...
Oh, what's that?
It's the one sure remedy for the common cold. Michael, if she hasn't heard you by now, she's not going to.
God save us. I've never been hanged before.
Don't worry, lad. You'll soon get the swing of it.
That was Events at the Salamander Hotel by Don Howard. Narrator, Stephen Thorne. Judge, Brian Haynes. Frank, John Badley. Harry and Inspector Forage, Peter Baldwin. Otto, Freddie Jones. Abraham, Charles E. Stidwell. George, Peter Woodthorpe. Captain Creek, David Ryle. Alvin, Blaine Fairman. Bishop, Hayden Jones. Barmaid, Carol Boyd. Irene, Diana Bishop. Michael, Michael Deacon. Sam, Brian Hewlett. Bob, Michael Shannon. The play was produced by Richard Whatley.